Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week, meditation instructor Jim Dunn concludes our examination of the book Ultimately Perfect by His Eminence Thai Sithu Rinpoche, taking a look at Chapter 6, Ultimately Perfect. What is our true nature? Our true nature is our Buddha nature, and therefore it is ultimately perfect. We simply need to uncover it. To achieve this realization, we must strive to get beyond duality and recognize our innate goodness, which, after all, is at the heart of our practice. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for coming. It's good to have people here today. It's been a while since I've been in a position to give a talk like this. I've been a part of the Sangha for over 20 years, but I lived in Santa Fe for 10 years, and so I wasn't around very much at all. And while I was in Santa Fe, I kept up with the Dharma, but in more the forest tradition, Theravadin, and then I went to a Zen center where I studied to be a chaplain and ordained as a chaplain, so they gave me this. So I thought I'd wear it because I don't get to wear it very often. And maybe it'll give me a little more authority and remind me that I'm supposed to know what I'm talking about. So we have been working through a book, Ultimately Perfect, by Thai Sithu Rinpoche, and he is the 12th Thai Sithu. He's been a teacher of the Karmapa, and the Karmapas have been his teachers through the centuries. He's one of the oldest lineages in the Kagyu tradition, and he's a very interesting guy to listen to, wonderful sense of humor, very open, easy to listen to, and his book has been very interesting to read, very profound, deep. So, this will be the last chapter on this book. I guess we still have a few more chapters on the lives of the Karmapa to work through. And then I think in June we are beginning another book, Interdependence, Interconnected, I think it is, by the Karmapa. So we usually begin these talks by setting the refuge chair, chant. And since Thai Sithu talks a lot about lineage, and I've never been very good at Tibetan, I will like to recite the lineage prayer, that the refuge prayer as I know it. It's from the Pali, and this is the prayer that has probably been chanted since the days of the Buddha and is still chanted all over the world. I will recite it twice in Pali and then once in English, and you may listen. If any of you know it, you may join along, but it begins, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa. Homage to the blissful one, the worthy one, the fully enlightened one. Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dhamman Saranam Gacchami. Sangan Saranam Gacchami. Dudiyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Dudiyampi Dhamman Saranam Gacchami. Dudiyampi Sangan Saranam Gacchami. To the Buddha, to refuge I go. To the teachings for refuge I go. To the spiritual community I go. And that's the refuge prayer in Pali. Unfortunately, I'm not a very good chanter. Never quite had the voice for it, but I like it. It really sounds wonderful when you get a room full of monks doing it. And it does have the authenticity of a very long lineage of Buddhism. Have you people been reading the book at all, or any familiarity with the book? A little bit? And I can talk freely, most of you haven't read it. Yeah. So I'd like to begin with a quote from the Mahamudra text of Longchenpa. O nobly born, now there is born in you exceeding compassion for all those living creatures who have forgotten their true nature. And that is my aspiration for you, to remember your true nature and to have compassions for all those who don't. Your true nature is basically the topic of this chapter, ultimately perfect. What he means by ultimately perfect, we often talk about as your Buddha nature, the Dharmakaya or Dharmadhatu. And this is something you've already have. You just need to kind of realize it, uncover it. And last week, Lama Kathy talked about the four seals of Buddhism, and this kind of follows that fairly nicely. As a refresher, the four seals are all compounded things are impermanent. All emotions are painful. Samsara is always unsatisfactory when we react to impermanent things, and we will always have some suffering. All phenomena are empty. Nirvana or enlightenment is beyond extremes. And so when we talk about these, we're talking about trying to actually realize our true nature, our ultimately perfect nature. And this is teaching on the ultimate truth. The Buddha taught on two levels, relative reality, relative truth, and ultimate truth. Relative truth is the world we live in, basically samsara, the world where karma plays out, where we have to eat, drink, go to sleep, where we have cravings for things, where we see things and we want to make them real, where we think we actually have a self, where we exist. And what he's teaching here is, this is all somewhat of an illusion, that these things do not have ultimate reality, but they exist because of our relationship with us. It is sort of this dualistic kind of point of view. So get to the ultimate truth is getting beyond duality. And he makes a distinction between ultimate duality and an ultimate duality beyond ultimate duality. I think what he's talking about with the first kind of duality is relative to relative reality. So ultimate perfection would be getting the mansion, the Mercedes-Benz, all these wonderful things. And that we think those would make us happy and life would be great. But I think we all kind of know that it doesn't really work that way. Even the new Mercedes will get a dent sooner or later. But ultimately perfect is stepping beyond all of that. It's getting beyond having to deal with all compounded things as compounded. Non-dualistic way of seeing things. So this chapter really focuses on the absolute or ultimate reality and our inherent fundamental goodness or Buddha nature. He begins by pointing out that what I just talked about, what he thinks of as the ultimate is the opposite of the relative. It's beyond that. It's something more than that. And for those of you who are interested in Buddhist philosophy, he's talking from a Shentong perspective of Madhyamaka philosophy. That's far more I need to get into today, but if you like to read that stuff, it's the direction to go. The easiest way to understand this, he suggests, is to look at our mind. In each of us, everything is perfect, and the one thing that is perfect is our mind. You may not realize that or quite think that as I sit here and say that, because our thoughts are not perfect. Our thoughts can be very troubling. But if you go deeper and deeper, and this is what our practice is about, meditation, studying the Dharma, doing the sadhanas, we go deeper and deeper, we begin to realize the mind really is more perfect than we think it is. It's clear, clarity, luminosity, limitless. And so he talks some about the defects of samsara by pointing out how while we've tried to create a perfect world in some ways, as we've all kind of know, we've created something of a mess. If you look at our environmental problems, how complicated we've made things, all the electronic things we have that we do to make life easier, and we enjoy many of those. You know, having a computer and smartphone really is a useful kind of thing for many of us. But they also come with problems. I just figured out today my phone needs a new battery. And that's something of a hassle. So many of our problems are self-inflicted. We've made what he calls a golden cage. We kind of are stuck in it, but we can get out of it. He's not recommending we give up all these conveniences. It's just that we shift our perspective, look at them a new way, look at them as not having the self-existent nature, as something that we've made with our minds. This is a concept that's sort of difficult to get our minds around sometimes. You know, we look at things and we see it. You know, sometimes I've used the example of a pen. We all look at this and it's a pen. As Eric pointed out last week, a dog might look at it as a chew toy. Just kind of reframing things. If I start to take it apart, at what point does it stop being a pen? It's made of parts. It's not inherently a pen. And no matter how far I take this apart, you will never find the quality of penness in this. Anything I can say about this or any other object comes from me, from my mind. You know, we learn these in our culture. We share these so we can communicate and live together. But everything we can say about anything in reality is from our side. It's not inherent. And as you work at understanding this and start to see things more that way, it's really liberating. It really is freeing. It gives you a chance, a way to make choices, to be more open, more creative. Some people talk about this as reframing, a concept I like. You know, if you shift your perspective on something, it can really change your point of view. I've done a lot of work with prisoners, and when I first started, I thought, well, maybe, gee, these are bad guys, difficult. But as I worked with them and I got to know them, kind of reframing them, as they're not prisoners, they're not felons, they're people, they're human. They have the same feelings I do. They want to be happy, they want to avoid suffering. They have not been always very skillful in how they try to get that. But that is still what they're trying for and what they want. And a lot of the people I've worked with in prison have turned out to be very good people. The first prisoner I worked with, Han Wan Zi, I met in Columbus in prison. He had come from China to go to graduate school. His wife had an affair, and he put a bullet in her lover's head. Now, he was sentenced to 20 years to life. And I worked with him the last 5 years and talking about the Dharma. He's a very bright guy. And he worked very hard, even went through Nundro in prison, and got a chance to catch up with him in China. He was released after 20 years, deported promptly to China. And I took a trip to China, well, partly to see China, but partly to connect with him again. And he's doing okay. He's a good man. He's got a fiance, she has a child that she's raising as his daughter. So, I mean, this guy that, you know, really did something bad is far more than that one thing. I mean, I guess the question I often ask people when they challenge working with prisoners is, how would you like to be judged by the worst thing you did in your life? Just go back and imagine all the things you've done. Everybody has done something that they're probably a little bit ashamed of. And if that's the thing that defines you, then I think, you know, you'd all be kind of very unhappy. The other thing I sometimes ask people is, have you ever stolen anything? Even taken a pad home, notepad home from the office? Something like that. I'm not going to ask anybody for hands. Anybody that's ever told a lie, made a misstatement? You probably would all have to agree to that. So in some ways, I'm talking to a bunch of lying thieves. Just can't quite make those generalizations. So, and Rinpoche even wonders about going back to being Neanderthals, back in the days when we didn't have anything. And he thought they didn't have any of these problems. They lived a much happier life, he thinks. Although, I kind of wonder, because in those days it was very brutal finding food. You didn't just go to the grocery store and whip out your credit card and have food. You had to really work pretty hard to get it. A lot of dangers around. Not much you could do about diseases, so even then life had its challenges. Everything has always been kind of problematic one way or another. So he goes on with the question of what is mind? Whatever is thinking thoughts is his answer. The thinker, where thoughts come from. And it's the thoughts that may not be perfect, but as you go deeper and deeper, the mind has so much depth to it that it gets to a point where it's beyond thoughts. The question of mind is still not quite understood. Well, I was in the Zen training program. We had a presentation, actually 5 days, on neuroscience. And these guys devote their lives to studying the brain, consciousness, those kinds of questions. And they can't come up with an answer that really is satisfactory to what's conscious, what is consciousness. So one of the things when I talk about spirituality is I just kind of like to use the word mystery. We live in a mystery. Some things there are not answers to. One of the ways you can get at the question of mind is sort of a Hindu method. In Christianity, I think they call it the via negativa, or apophatic reasoning. And that's just kind of looking, is this mind? Is this mind? No, not this. Not this. Not this. And you get to a point where you just don't know. And you get to that point of not knowing. And that can kind of open something up. That's how Zen koans work. These impossible questions. What is the sound of one hand clapping? And if you take those seriously, as they do in the Zen tradition, which I think most of us have a hard time getting our minds around, contemplating a lot, what's the sound of one hand clapping? But it becomes a way of kind of breaking our mind open, of rethinking things, of letting go of a lot of our conceptuality. So everything is a manifestation of mind in some ways. He talks a little bit about the perfections of heaven and the defects of hell. Do you guys know about the six realms? You know, in Buddhism, we sometimes talk about the idea of rebirth, and you have the wheel of Dharma. I wish we had a talk of that here, but there are six realms you can be reborn in. One is the hell realm, which is filled with angry beings, those that are very hateful. The hungry ghosts, which somebody describes America, these are people often are beings detected with very long, thin necks and huge bellies. They can never be satisfied. They always want. They're always in need of more. The animal realm, where things aren't quite so bad, but there's always a certain amount of fearfulness, always worrying about a predator, something like that. The human realm, which the teachings tell us is the best realm to be born into, because in the human realm, we actually have the intelligence and the time and the being, well-being to practice Dharma, to study Dharma. This is our precious life of leisure and opportunity, and so something to be grateful for and want to stay in. The next realm is the Titan realm, sometimes I think called the Asuras, and those are the ones I think are the I put people that run corporations, the people that, you know, are making huge amounts of money, our current president. They want power, control. That's what really obsesses them is power. They're always fighting for more in a different way than the hungry ghosts. And then the God realm, which everything is perfect and too perfect to even think about practicing Dharma because you have everything you want, just lovely. I think of that as the trust fund kids. Born with a fortune. So those are the six realms you can be born in. In the God realm, he talks about, you get in there by results of, you know, good behavior, positive actions. And it's really good for quite a while, a very long time. Many kalpas or eons, according to the teachings. But eventually that karma runs out and you're reborn. You can be reborn in any of the other realms, he seems to be thinking, even a human. If you had been born in the Gone realm and come back as a human. He says you're very happy, very jolly kind of person. So anyway, being in God realm is not all bad. Negative behavior is what sends us to the hell realm, where everything bad happens. And this is all a result of our karma. Everything is a manifestation of mind, the manifestation of our karma, our actions. Even if we're identical twins, things are always different. Our minds are different. If any of you know identical twins, they may look the same and have a lot of the same thoughts, but they always have, you know, really differences. I know my daughter had a couple of friends growing up that were identical twins, and a lot of similarities, but one became a nurse and one got a PhD in science. So a little different track, but a little bit of an overlap. So since we've stated that mind itself is perfect, then ultimately everything is perfect. And this is why we do meditations, practices, prayers, why we try to be helpful, nice, tolerant, compassionate. These things are positive. Being disrespectful, cynical, angry, these are negative. And we do the positive to possibly, you know, reborn either as a human or maybe in the God realm to have a better life next time around, or maybe to really achieve enlightenment in this life. So everything is interconnected. All the things we do is always interconnected. Thoughts come from thoughts. Things are related through other things. As I pointed out with the pen, it depends on its parts to work as a pen, and it works on our seeing it as a pen to be used as a pen. You know, you've probably seen objects that look very different than their use if you didn't know what they were at first. So what else do I have here? Yeah, things are interconnected, interdependent, impermanent, changing. But if they were perfect, they wouldn't be changing. So the universe is in constant flux. So we have something of a paradox, which always puts us, I think, in the heart of real spirituality, the mystery. So the next question the Rinpoche asks is, why do you need to know all this? Is it relevant? And he actually says, no, it's not particularly relevant now. We're living in a relative reality. We ultimately were perfect, but right now we're not quite. But the idea is to get there. So as we do these practices, maybe we'll become a little more positive. We'll get a little more free from duality. As we think of things in the world, objects, as not being ultimately real, I mean, but as compounded, impermanent things, we can begin to see that our attachment to them doesn't have to be so much. You know, we can look at some nice shiny piece of jewelry or a new car as really kind of a neat thing, but, you know, it's a compounded thing. It's impermanent. It won't last. And it may bring me some pleasure now, but after a while it won't. And it'll break down and need repairs and cause other problems in my life. So I really don't need to get too excited about it. You can do that with a lot of things you look at. And as you just think that way, you begin to lose a little bit of your attachment to the relative world. You get a little bit of liberation. As you do your practices and meditations and go deeper, this becomes a little more automatic. And then perhaps finally, after a while, you really have a deep realization of this, and you won't have a problem at all. For most of us, that'll take a while. I still see things I want, things I like, things I don't want to give up. But I also understand that I can have a good and happy life without any of them. It's not a tragedy if I lose some of the things I have, some of my possessions, my toys. And as you work at that, as understanding that, of getting your mind around that, you can do this as both by the critical thinking, examining it, analyzing it, and that is part of our practice. We don't talk so much about using that kind of meditation, of analytical meditation, but it is a good way to begin to look at things. And as you look at the challenges in your life, the difficulties that can come up, thinking about them as kind of related and caused by karma, past karma. And then you can think, gee, this is a bad thing that happened. So I've just paid a debt. Somewhere along the line, I did something bad. I offended somebody. Maybe this life, maybe another life. But now I'm free of that. I think the Tibetan word is pakshak. You know, it's just a little moment of liberation from something in the past. Sort of like, you know, you've gone to jail, you've done your time, now you're a free man. And each time any of that happens, from just getting a headache or a dent in your car to something big, it's useful to think of that. Now, I know some of the teachings say not everything is caused by karma. Some things happen by chance. The Buddha says sometimes the winds and some of the other things cause things. So it's not all karma necessarily, but it's still a useful way, I find, to look at things, to give them meaning, to make some sense out of all the difficulties that happen in my life. And that is the entire practice of Dharma, is about this. Getting free of our past lives. Ultimately, there is no past or future, but it'll be a while before we fully understand that. And Rinpoche talks a little bit about religion. And why can't I just be a good person? Why do I need a religion at all? And here he gets into the idea of lineage, which is what I began this talk with the Pali Refuge Prayer. We can work hard at being a good person, but maybe we'll make a mistake. Maybe we think doing something that is good, being a good person, really is different. Having the lineage, having the teachers, can kind of keep us on the path. You know, this is not the way to go. I think it was Ajahn Shah was asked why he told one student this and another student that, and he says basically what he does as a teacher is you're going along the path, and if you go a little too far to the left, I get you back to the center. If you go a little too far to the right, I get you back to the center. I keep you on the path. And it's so easy for us to wander off the path. So that's one of the reasons why having a lineage and having the authenticity of a tradition, and our tradition goes back hundreds, if not thousands of years, beginning with the original Buddha, about 2,600 years ago. And our Tibetan tradition goes back well over 1,000 years. So that is the importance of lineage. It really does keep us on the path. It is important. And getting off of that is just simply not safe. But, yeah, we'll still have suffering. But I said, you know, the karmic debts are being paid. So that is essentially, I guess this was a shorter talk than I thought, but I hope you guys have questions. There's a whole lot to talk and unpack here. And I would like to end with just a quote from Sunryu Suzuki, the Zen teacher in California. He just wanted to remind all of his students. He said, "You are perfect just the way you are, and there's still room for improvement." So let's see if we can have a discussion.
You said something about a Shen Tong view on there, but I didn't get the second part of that.
Shen Tong, it's part of the Madhyamaka middle way teachings of Buddhist philosophy.
All right. Which exact middle way teaching? Hmm? I read that there's two versions of the middle way school of thinking.
Yeah, this is all part of that. There's a number of variations on that, and that's getting into a philosophy that is above my pay grade to talk about here, and something that at this point I don't think we need to talk about. If you are interested in that, you can find books and stuff online about it.
All right.
Other questions, comments?
Could you talk a little bit more about duality?
Duality?
Yeah.
Talk about duality.
It took me a long time to kind of get an idea of what that was all about. I expect that I have a lot more to learn on that.
Duality is basically the way we see the world. You know, there's me and you. And you get the idea that I am the separate being from you, or separate from this object. And it's the easy way to fall into. I mean, we, you know, think of ourselves, you know, I have this body and I have these thoughts and these are my thoughts. I have my car. It's not your car. So we kind of divide the world into things that like are me and not me. And as we get past that, we start to see that, you know, it really is all interconnected and there really is no big distinction. It's the way we live in the world and the way we almost have to live in the world. But, you know, we talk about good, we talk about bad. And in an ultimate level, there is neither good nor bad. It just is. And that's the hard part to kind of get your mind around, is that it just is. Ultimate reality is something that you really can't fully articulate, because to articulate it is to get back into duality using words, concepts. You know, the old Taoist thing, the Tao that can be spoken is not the true Tao. Any other comments on duality? No, Ron.
Yeah, well, is that, could you also say the, in the five skandhas, the third one is perception, and it's my understanding as you go from form to feeling to perception, it's like what the mind automatically compares. It perceives something and it tries to identify if it's big or small, hot or cold, or, you know, and that's like a duality there.
Mm-hmm.
Could you say that's the same thing?
Yeah, that is kind of how our mind works and how we want it, how it wants to work. As we do our practice and kind of become more aware and deeper into exploring our mind, meditating on the nature of mind, you start to break away from that a little bit. You know, the idea of seeing things as they are is seeing them from beyond that. But the immediate response of the mind is to, you know, make it big, small, hot, cold, white, black, whatever. Does that help?
Yeah.
Hi. Can you remind me the four, I forget what you call them, but the four jewels or just the four principles? Seals.
The four seals that I began with? Yeah, they are all compounded things are impermanent. And compounded means, you know, made of parts, made of other things. Nothing is entire. You know, and as we look at things from even the sense of, you know, modern day physics, it gets broken down into particles that are smaller and smaller and smaller. And they still don't quite understand all of that, and they can't quite decide if some things are solid or waves. All emotions are painful. Samsara is always unsatisfactory. All phenomena are empty, which is what I've been talking about a lot, that they don't have inherent qualities from their side. Anything we can say about anything in the world comes from our mind. We add it, we kind of make the world that way, which is why, you know, the Dhammapada, the Lama Kathy likes to begin with is, you know, all things come from our mind, and with our minds we make the world. And the last one is Nirvana, enlightenment is beyond extremes. Hmm. And that's when we really start to see things as they are, not as compounded, but clearly. And so,
Yeah, I think that fourth one, the everything's beyond extremes, that's the one that kind of holds it all together for me, because with, especially like the idea that everything is relative, like if you take that to the extreme, then there's no like objective truth. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if everything's just objective truth, then there's no subjectivity, no meaning, like the meaning of the pen, that's a subjective truth. Mm-hmm. So it's like, finding that balance is part of the middle way, but I think that's something that can be challenging sometimes, is to find that middle ground where both the subjective truth and the objective truth play against each other, but like reinforce each other.
Yeah, and we talk about the middle way, the way the Buddha talked about the middle way, is that on the one hand you have nihilism. nothing matters at all, is of any importance. And the other, we have this absolute materialism. Everything is solid and materialistic. And in between, you have that path that we take, the middle way.
Yeah,
that's helpful. Does that help?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments, responses?
Yes, thanks for your talk. And I have a question. I hope this isn't trite, but I'm sort of interested in the six realms. I mean, I've been coming here for a while. I don't really, my practice isn't the best, but I enjoy the Dharma talks a lot. And the six realms, I mean, it sort of sounded like something off of Barkhazy board, you know, but then I heard Lama Kathy gave a Dharma talk, you know, about a month or two ago. She talked about the six realms. It was very practical, very pragmatic. And so my question, I guess, on the, you know, essentially it seems like in our relative reality that we know, it seems like we could only be aware of the animal realm and the human realm. And the demigods and the god, that's like some positive other world. And the ghost realms are some positive negative world, you know, in a horror movie stuff, you know. And so how did they, I mean, on a practical aspect, it seems like Dharma Krathi came up with the six realms and very practical. How can we look at the other, like, the other four realms, negative and positive realms, as, you know, as a real, as something really real or something?
Yeah, well, there's a Zen story that sort of gets at a little bit of that. A samurai was walking down the road, and he saw the Zen master sitting there. And he comes up to him and says, "You're a Zen master. Can you tell me about heaven and hell?" And the Zen master says, "Why would I talk to an ugly son of a bitch like you?" You don't say that to a samurai. He raised his sword and is about ready to strike, very angry, enraged, offended. The Zen master says, "That's hell." The samurai kind of realizes, has a realization then, that the Zen master really is wise, lowers his sword, relaxes, smiles, and the Zen master says, "That's heaven." So that's kind of getting in there a little bit. I like that story. But I think of the hymn realms as sort of states we can go through, you know, in our lives. When you're really angry, enraged, you're in the hell realm. When you're really feeling, "I need that, I want that," when you're walking through the store and you'll, "How much credit do I have? My credit card? Can I buy this, that?" You know, that is the hungry ghost, this need, this desire. When we just don't quite know what we're doing, kind of lost here, or maybe just kind of responding to being hungry or something, that's the animal realm. The human realm you ought to be familiar with. You've been living in it all your life. The next realm, the Titan realm, is those people that feel like they need to run things, they want power, they want authority. And maybe you've held that feeling of wanting power and then maybe getting a little bit and getting excited about it and thinking, maybe I want more power than getting. And then every now and then you'll have some times in your life when everything is just perfect. You could stay that way forever. And while that lasts, you know, you're kind of in the God realm for a few minutes. And you can kind of start thinking of things somewhat that way. Does that make some sense?
Yeah. Yes, it does. I mean, almost it seems like the demigod realm and God could really go into the negative really quick. Because a god could be pretty nasty, you know? It's just because you have all that power. And we can just look at the world and see, you know, what things are like, you know? But the stewards are not particularly...
Well, the demigod realm is not particularly positive. Yeah, no, it is characterized by the constant competition, the fighting, the demanding. Our president, I think, is a good example of somebody living in that realm.
Golden toilet seat.
I shouldn't get political here, should I? I think that's a Dharma statement, not a political statement.
All right. Well, thanks.
I wanted to ask more about the second of the four seals they were talking about, saying that you said every emotion is a form of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that if you actually, if it's an emotion that you want, it's bad or impious to actually want it?
It's not bad or impious. It just leads to suffering. You know, we talk about the first noble truth, that there is suffering. The Pali word for that is dukkha. And it actually is better translated as unsatisfactory. The root meaning of dukkha comes from the idea of a wheel that's a little out of round. In the cart going down the road, you're always going to have just these little bumps. It's never going to be a perfectly smooth ride. And if you get an emotion that's really positive, satisfactory, you like it, it's not going to last. It's going to change. There's going to be a bump. Something will change. So it's not impious to have any emotion. It's not, you know, we don't have the idea of sin in Buddhism. You know, we talk about karma, positive karma, negative karma, having consequences. The things we do kind of create the lives we have. The thoughts we think, you know, kind of inform that. So as we work at thinking purer thoughts, better thoughts, we'll have a better life and behave better. But no, there's no idea of something impious or a bad emotion. Now, sometimes you might think, you know, you're looking at somebody that you don't like and you want to think, I wish they were dead, or I wish harm would come to them. That might be a thought you'd want to look at and say, gee, that's not a very skillful thought.
I was going to ask another thing with that. I was seeing a thing by, I think it was Kalu Rinpoche was saying that with the Bardo becoming, that people reincarnate in the human realm because of their attachment to their habits, specifically the fact that animals don't have habits like humans do, and that when they reincarnate and they're moving through the tunnel, they get a glimpse of their their future life's going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that if you wanted to reincarnate in the human realm, the type of emotion or suffering that you would have would be the kind that would arise from the habits that you have?
In some ways, I think you can say that. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche once quipped, I like the quip, but I'm not sure quite how accurate it was, but he's generally a very good teacher, is what gets reincarnated is your bad habits. So those are the things. It's your actions in this life, all of them kind of combine, that kind of propel you on into the next life. So I suppose if you've been very stupid or hateful or greedy, you might wind up in one of the lower realms.
But does that mean that in sort of a sense that if, let's say you have a multiple forms of suffering, like you have a bad habit, but you actually want to have that bad habit, you have a mistake you make, anger, and other habits, the ones that you don't actually want to roll over to the next reincarnation are the ones that you should deal with?
Well, one of the reasons why we practice is to try to overcome our bad habits. Why we come to these teachings and come to some sort of religious lineage, as I said before, is it gives us some guidance on how to do that and how to work with those kinds of things. If you have a bad habit that you know is bad, then you really need to work on a way to give it up. Our meditation practices, sadhana practices, teachings, all are kind of geared to help you deal with those kinds of habits, to help you get out of suffering, out of samsara, to give you a little more liberation, freedom. Does that help?
I'm asking more along the lines of how do you choose which habits to deal with, or do you work on all of them?
The habits to work on, to cultivating, are the ones that lead to happiness, well-being, being satisfied, being happy. Ones that, you know, help you to get along with other people. The idea of all of this, as somebody put it, the whole purpose of the Dharma is basically to lead to human flourishing, that we'll have good lives and live well. That's why we do all of this, why we do our practices. I'm not sure what kind of habits you're talking about, but you know, anything that you do kind of without much thinking or just too automatically, it might be good to examine and wonder if you can think about that a little more clearly. as you do the practices, you'll find that your mind becomes a little more open, and you'll be able to respond more intelligently to things. You won't be quite as reactive. Your habits, you'll become a little more free from them. They will loosen their ties on you. So that's kind of what we're going for, is to become more responsive. Another Zen master once asked, what's the purpose of all Dharma? And his answer was, an appropriate response. I like the Zen master. It's always a little bit enigmatic, but very wise, very clear. So you can kind of ponder that a little bit. An appropriate response is the purpose of all Dharma. Whatever occurs, we'll respond to it in a way that is appropriate. Is that making some sense?
Yes, it does. Should you attempt to achieve anything in life?
Did what?
Is it a good thing to achieve anything?
Well, yeah. Yeah, no, we live in this world. We live in a relative world. Achieving things is good. You know, achieving enlightenment is wonderful. You know, and you may want to take a vow of poverty, become a monk, or devote yourself entirely to practice. But if you're not ready to do that, to give up this worldly life and move into a monastery, then yeah, achieving stuff is good. Just remember that it's not the most important thing always. To let go of some of the really grasping for it, but to enjoy it, to find pleasure in it. I mean, the idea of all this partly is to be happy. You know, when I began meditating, one of the things I discovered, actually, I was a little happier than I was before. And it's kind of stayed with me. It has continued.
It's surprising there's not more questions.
Oh, I must be very clear. Or else I've left you all totally baffled. I'm not sure which. So, anybody else have a curiosity or comment? We have a few more minutes. I have to get the hang of doing these talks. I thought I had a 40-minute talk, and it turned out to be about 30. So if there is nothing else, then I guess we'll just dedicate the merit. And yeah, there's always something else, James.
With the animal realm, where do plants come from?
I don't think we consider them as sentient beings. So they're not quite in the animal realm.
So is an animal without a brain sentient?
Can what?
Does the brain make it sentient?
Well, consciousness does, and that is, you know, one of the mysteries. But yes, animals do have consciousness. They are sentient.
So plants don't need enlightenment then?
At this point, not part of our lineage, part of our teaching. Now, I've read some stuff about plants. We may have to rethink that, but I am not sure how accurate that is. But, you know, there's books out there on the life of trees and how they communicate and respond to things. So maybe we do need to rethink that a little bit. But at this point, it's part of our lineage. We do not say that trees, plants have consciousness, that they're sentient beings. Although, like all living things, we should treat it as respect. Take care of the environment. So let's take a few moments to dedicate the merit that all people, all beings everywhere may realize their ultimate perfection, and that we can relieve the suffering of all those beings in the world. And since we're Tifereth Israel, hold a few moments for the thoughts and the people in Los Angeles that were victims of hate crimes this past few days. One death, several wounded. And so let's just dedicate the merit to those things. So thank you all for coming.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.